The number one in Montreal. Come on down to 9550 Jean Milhaud in LaSalle for the best patties, roadies, jerk chicken, and more. Or call us at 438-387-4004. Carib Patties, the champions of Montreal.
Good morning, Montreal. You are tuned to the Wednesday Morning After on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We have an arts and culture extravaganza for you today with three pre-recorded interviews. The first interview is from Helen Chow Bradley, author of Personal Attention Role Play. Being non-binary and Asian, they deal with the worlds of trans, non-binary, and Asian among all lives queer in a collection of short stories that are sure to please. The second interview is with Manolis Antonaiu of the May and Buluki Theatre for his multidisciplinary piece, The Future is Another Country. The third interview is with queer author Eli Turek, writer of The Good Arabs. 8 o'clock brings Democracy Now!, 8:15 brings Weather, and we'll listen to some music until we welcome the podcast In the Shower with Taz and Marcus. This week's question is, how is glass made? After some more music, we'll wrap up the show. Let's start the day off with some music.
Thank you. thought of all that I could say to you. Even after all the things you put me through, I felt it in my veins. Still, I played all your games. Why was it so hard for me to see the truth? Everything I did is the same. Every time you walked away, every time I let you get the best of me, I let you stay. How will nothing's left to say? Who'll be the one to blame? When your shadow's all that's left for you, you know the name. Is this a part where I give in? Is this a part?
to watch as it unfolds.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Metonymy is releasing Personal Attention Role Play, a debut collection of short stories by Montreal author Helen Chow Bradley. The stories are propelled by queer loneliness, mixed race confusion, late capitalist despondency, and the pitfalls of intimacy. Taking place in Montreal, Toronto, and elsewhere, they feature young Asian misfits struggling with the desire to see themselves reflected in their surroundings, in others, online. With us today, we have Helen Chow Bradley. Hi, Helen, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to write Personal Attention Role Play.
Sure. So my name is Helen Chow Bradley. I live in Jaujage or Montreal. I am a former musician and arts administrator and bookseller, and I am currently spending most of my time writing. Oh yeah, fun fact, I used to co-host Venus Radio on CKUT, so it's nice to have an interview at the station. So personal attention role play, the collection came together, I would say slowly over the past 2 or 3 years. I'd always been interested in the short story form, and after a lot of reading of many, many short stories and sort of getting my courage up, I decided to try to write some myself. I'm inspired by all sorts of things, you know, from things that I read and see online to things that my friends and communities talk about and joke about and are affected by, to my own, you know, internal neuroses and existential dread. And I would say the collection contains my 10 strongest stories to date. And as you mentioned, it's being published by Metonymy Press, who are a well-known queer trans feminist publisher based in this city.
What is your educational background as a writer?
So I don't have a formal education background as a writer. I did do a couple of degrees, but neither of them were in creative writing or any kind of creative field. I will say I did have to write a master's thesis at one point, which was more in the sociology vein, but it actually turns out to have been a really good warm-up for writing a book of fiction, just in that I had to learn how to receive edits and I had to write an in-depth long-form project on a pretty serious deadline. I would say most of my, you know, education as a writer has been of the informal type. I've always been a really big reader ever since I was a kid, and I really think that reading a wide array of writers has been my best writing teacher for the most part. Something I've found useful, and I would recommend this, you know, if you're trying to get started in creative writing and you aren't able or don't want to do a creative writing degree, I really recommend taking shorter workshops. And one of the things with the pandemic is that, you know, more writing workshops have become more accessible via being online. So I've been able to take some writing workshops out of centers in New York and elsewhere in the US that I wouldn't have been able to do normally. I think it's a really good way to learn how to give and receive feedback on writing and also to build community with other writers who you wouldn't meet otherwise. Because I think one of the things I missed out on a little bit, not having done a creative writing degree, is not having a ton of ties to other writers, especially outside of the city that I live in. I did manage to do a BAMF residency, which was great. And I did, you know, expand my writing community a bunch through that, but it was also unfortunately cut short by the beginning of the pandemic.
Which stories can we expect to read and what are they about?
There are 10 stories in the book. I would say some of them are more in the realist vein and others are a little more eerie or even verging into speculative territory. The opening story is about a young gymnast who develops a crush on an older girl in her competitive gymnastics program and is at the same time contending with her very irritable, overworked Chinese mom at home. The title story, Personal Attention Role Play, is about a 20-something-year-old who becomes entangled in an obsessive relationship with her roommate. They're both Asian and they're both queer, and although they are not the same and don't even look the same, they often get categorized as the same when they're out in public. I think that's a somewhat frequent occurrence for people like me. So when the roommate finally gets fed up and leaves, the narrator places her with this hypnotic Japanese ASMR channel that she then becomes obsessed with. The last story is a story about a queer metal band who they bring one of their boyfriends, who is seemingly this very like helpful, supportive guy. So they bring him on tour with them as their tour manager. But slowly over the course of the tour, they come to realize that they've made a very massive mistake. And I won't spoil it by saying what happens afterwards. I'm interested in how people can form very like obsessive bonds with each other in various relationships, especially if they have had like similarly difficult or traumatic experiences. And I look at this in relationships that could be, you know, roommates, friends, lovers, creative collaborators, and even parent-child relationships. I'm interested in how people can sometimes get so reliant on each other that they completely lose track of themselves. And I'm interested in playing and writing in that space.
Which societal issues inspire the stories and how do these affect you personally?
Oh, there's a whole range. Let's say like misogyny, racism, homophobia, transphobia, the way that abuse often runs rampant in creative communities, resource scarcity under capitalism, social isolation, all kinds of things. I should, you know, mention that these are fictional stories, so the characters aren't me, and, you know, they often do and say and think things that I don't do or think or say, but I personally am, you know, affected by some of those issues to varying extents, either because of my own, you know, placement in the world, like I am mixed race, I'm queer and non-binary, etc., or, you know, because of simply living in the world that we live in with all of its inequalities, and also because of being, you know, an active part of various activist and artistic and neighborhood communities. I'm definitely more interested in asking via fiction or playing with questions rather than telling people what to do or figuring out what solutions to these like massive questions are. I don't tend to enjoy fiction that's really prescriptive, so I try not to write it either. I'm also interested in disappointment and failure as themes. I'm interested in how those states can provoke change in people for better or often for worse.
Will you please read us 4 minutes passages from your collection?
Sure. So I'm choosing to read a section from a story called Soft Shoulder. And that's the last story that I mentioned. I picked it just because it's, you know, this is CKUT and this is a story about a band. It's the one that I described a little earlier, so I'll just read a section from the beginning. Soft Shoulder. The van was packed full, belly riding low over the asphalt. Each pothole on the way out of the city jolted the drum stands, punctuating our caffeinated chatter with staccato clangs. Taylor, travel mug in one hand, merged us onto the 15, which was pitted and sagging even more than it had been on our last tour. We were, impressively, only 2 hours behind schedule. Imagine we get a flat before we even cross the border, Sarita said, bracing herself in the passenger seat. Maybe we should have replaced the spare after all. Logan let out a small, alarmed noise, but we laughed. Hecate's approach to touring was to expect the worst and to have as much fun as possible in the meantime. We weren't planners. We worked with chaos. We did it for the transcendent moments, those flashes when the sweat and the feedback and the lights and the crush of bodies collided in a hot burst. But between those fleeting crests, it was mostly loading gear up and down unventilated stairwells, getting misgendered and patronized during soundcheck, rinsing out our sour underwear in some grimy punk house sink, pissing in slurpy containers and tossing them out the window as the van accelerated finally up the ramp to the eternal highway, where nothing but gridlock, entropy, and endless tolls awaited. This tour would be charmed, though. Hope pulsed through us, despite our attachment to pessimism. For the first time, we had touring visas, and we rolled through the border at Lake Champlain with the confidence of the ordained. Gone were the days of covering our tattoos, flashing perky smiles, and pretending we are driving down to New York for a girls' shopping trip, OMG, while some friend of a friend of a friend with a US passport drove all our instruments and amps through a different crossing for $50, and we prayed that they wouldn't just decide to steal all of it. Also, for the first time, we had our very own white American man with us, the official tour manager on the official paperwork, plus all our gear, proudly slotted into the back of the van like a heavy game of Tetris. Still, Sarita was tense as the men with the guns flipped through her passport. We felt her uncoil after they waved us through, and the low buildings of the checkpoint receded behind us. Welcome to America, ladies. Logan beat an enthusiastic drum roll on the back of Taylor's seat. We're going to absolutely murder this tour. You won't be the same band when it's over. I know it. We snickered a bit at his earnestness, but the thrill of new connections and opportunities eclipsed our usual derision. Taylor smiled into the rear view, breaking into a full grin when Logan met her eyes and smiled back. Logan seemed, tentatively, to be a good guy, or a fine guy, a passably thoughtful dude who retweeted the right accounts and commented on the right posts and frequently voiced his intentions to not take up too much space. For instance, he had recently joined the charge against multiple influential male figures in the Montreal music scene. A trickle of call-outs ranging from emotional manipulation to harassment to assault had led to a deluge. Logan had spearheaded an accountability process for a racialized female DJ and the white male booker who had refused to pay her performance fee after she turned down one of his many hookup proposals. There were receipts, but the process inevitably got messy, and eventually everyone agreed it had to be abandoned. At least Logan had tried, we thought. Taken a public stand, risked his growing reputation as a real player in the local hierarchy. It was more, far more, than we could say of most of the men we knew. And now we were bringing him along on tour, hoping that he was serious about opening industry doors for us, about not disrupting our trinity. He was so adamant about his connections, how Hecate, our band, was the next big thing, but the right people hadn't heard about us yet. His confidence was infectious.
Where have you been published previously, and why is this full-length version such an exciting project?
So previously, I have published essays and reviews and some stories in places like Maisonneuve, Rice Paper, Carte Blanche, the Montreal Review of Books, Cosmonauts Avenue, and some other places. There's also a new Montreal-based anthology that just came out called Weird Era that I have a piece in, and there is a launch for that in early October. I did also publish a chapbook of experimental poetry with House House Press, which is another small local press. But yeah, this is my first book, and it's very exciting to have a full-length book out. I hope that it will mean that more and more people are able to read my work. I think I write primarily in order to reach other people and be read and maybe have interesting conversations with them or not, or just to know that other people are reading my stuff. Plus, I really love physical books. My apartment's full of them, and now one of the titles will be mine.
Where do you intend to tour the book?
That's kind of a tough question because of the ongoing pandemic. I know that I will have a launch of some sort in Jaujage, Montreal in mid-October, so stay tuned for that. Beyond that, it's pretty unclear whether anyone can or should be live touring at this time, especially as we move into fall and winter, you know, because my pub date isn't until mid-October, but I'm hoping to somehow eventually do events, at least in a few other cities in Canada. You know, I'd really like to go to Toronto and Vancouver and Halifax and a few other places, but whether that's like in person or whether it ends up being over Zoom, I really can't say yet.
If our listeners want more information or to buy your book, where should they go?
Well, you can currently pre-order the book from the Metonymy Press website, and you will be able to buy copies as well as of October 19th. Pre-orders are really helpful for small presses, so I really encourage you to do that if you're interested. So the website is www.metonymypress.com, and metonymy is spelled M-E-T-O-N-Y-M-Y. So once you go to the website, just click on the books tab and you'll see all of the books that they have that you can order. And also as of October 19th, you'll be able to buy it at your local bookstore, which as a former bookseller, I really encourage you to do. You know, indie bookstores need a lot of support right now. And yeah, I really encourage people to support local brick and mortar stores.
Well, thank you for your interview today.
Thanks, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Helen Chow Bradley speaking about their work personal attention role play. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
Early in the morning, before the sun rose, when the first bird sang, even while everyone was still asleep.
Morning. On that morning.
When the sun comes out.
This morning, baby.
Cock-a-doodle-doo. I hear the rooster crowing.
Now you must wake up. Now every morning when I wake up,
I woke up this morning with
the kiss of the morning.
Got up 7:30 every morning. Had the same breakfast.
Réveillez-moi à 8 heures demain matin.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Riding a bike made of bacon and eggs.
In the morning.
In the morning.
In the morning.
Why should the sun replace the moonlight?
Has this ever happened to any of you? Or will it happen to any of you on the morning after the night before?
You are listening to The Morning After on CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial.
If individualism saturates the present, securing it, but just for some, what will the future be made of? The future is another country grapples with this question via a single staple, the potato. A storehouse of nutrients and narratives, Manolis Antonou Bouloukhi Theater uses this historically rich root vegetable as a bridge to territory, hospitality, adaptation, settler existence, and the limits of meaning. With us today, we have Manolis Antonou of Bouloukhi Theater. Hi, Manolis, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Sheila. I'm very happy to be here with you.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to be involved with the Humble Potato.
As you mentioned already, my name is Manolis. I've been in Canada since 2014, in Montreal, and then a bit in Ottawa. I've been working, studying, I did a bit of studies here, and I've been working since then independently, producing and directing my own work. Yeah, with the future in as another country, we started working on some ideas about togetherness and about coexistence and about the means or even the items, the physical items that can bring people together. Food came very early on in our process of working, both playing with it on stage, like the performers actually playing with it, even consuming it. And then to a point we arrived to that moment in our process where we realized that we have to extend that joy of playing and eating food with the audience in our process, because I happen to work with people who are all new settlers of Canada. All of my collaborators are people who have been in Canada and in Montreal a number of years, and they come from other countries. We realized as we're looking into food that potato, the potato, as you mentioned, the humble potato, is the staple food that actually we felt very connected on a personal level from our own perspective countries and our own perspective families. But also then we realized that it's this staple food that has been the most resilient, the most connecting, the most adapting to other habitats, the most also nationalized, if you may. It always felt that, you know, I come from a place that we produce in Greece the best potato in Greece. And I always felt that potato, you know, always was there. And it's kind of like, I felt like an ownership over it. And then we found similar stories in our kind of like personal backgrounds. And then of course you go through the research and then you realize that, you know, it's a very new staple food for, you know, the majority of the world, that actually it comes from these lands, from the indigenous lands. Originally potato comes from Peru. So yeah, in that way, we decided to go with the potato, and we are playing with the potato. We are serving potatoes. And we also make an assumption that everybody likes potatoes one way or another, you know, even chips, which are potatoes.
What is your background in theater to date? How did you become involved in the Bouloukhi Theater?
Before coming to Canada, before deciding to move to Canada, I was in Greece. I was in Athens, based in Athens, and I was working in theater, but I was behind the scenes. So I was a production director of a festival and a theater company. And I was doing pretty much my career there in various levels, pretty much everything except acting and directing. So I have I'm very well versed in theater making processes. And then I came to Canada. I pursued a degree at Concordia University and one at Ottawa University. Yeah, and then, you know, I realized that my need but also I was able to obtain the vocabulary that I needed to in order to be able to step out. I mean, I'm still behind the scenes because I never perform, but now I'm like, it's my own artistic voice that I, you know, I'm able to stage. And Buluki, it's kind of like it's a somewhat collective group, I would say, led by me, with permanent collaborators who we work together in a somewhat collective manner in order to create and stage our ideas. Yeah, we've been around since end of 2017. This is our third show here, Fusion of the Country. We've already done Medea Material by Hannah Mueller in 2018, and in 2019 we did Illusion by Ivan Viripayev. Yeah, it's a way of working that is a bit nomadic, if you may. Like, people come and go. So yeah, that's it.
Where did the idea for the future is another country come from?
There's like many things. I mean, one, you know, as I told you already, you know, we all are settlers. You know, we are all, you know, immigrants and newcomers in this country with various statuses also. Some people have obtained citizenship, some people are on green cards, some people are, you know, they don't have any status in my team. So official legal status, I mean, like citizenship or green card. So, you know, our experience of being in a new place that has its own history, that we carry also our own histories. And then, you know, there was a lot, you know, there's always that clash of cultures or of languages or of cultural codes that you have to go through when you are leaving your own place and you go to a new place. So that was a big part of our discussion and our process. And we're always wondering, can it work? You know, is there a way, or is there a place even, you know, an actual place, a physical place, where those ideas of, you know, coexistence and togetherness and access and visibility are can actually exist? And the kind of like the spark of this kind of like the reference point of us for starting becoming a bit more specific in our process were a couple of books. One was this book called Lavapolis, where the writer describes an island. But it's kind of like it's a bit utopic, a description of a world, but in a very real way. So it doesn't place that island in another world. It plays that island in the world that we live in, where it's only 70 years old. Nobody is a national. Everybody is a settler of that island, because up until 70 years ago, it didn't have any habitats. So suddenly there was a description of a place that felt very real, that actually it can work with all its problems, of course, you know, not perfect, but it can work. So through that, we started playing the idea of country, what it means, of future, of present. One more big reference in our work that, you know, also it has stayed with us, because at some point we had to put Lavapolis on the side, but the other big reference that has carried through until the end, and it's big part of the show actually, is a lecture that Michel Foucault gave, Des Autres Espaces, Utopie and Heterotopie, of other spaces, Utopias and Heterotopias, where he describes of like these spaces in the world that we're living in that can be still be part of the world we're living in, but then in those spaces, we all have equal access. For example, you know, he describes the theater as a heterotopia. He describes, you know, the museum as a heterotopia, the cemetery as a heterotopia. So it's been kind of like big part of our process to create, you know, in combination with the history of the potato, to like really try to like play and create a space where in that given moment in time, when we are with the audience on that Tuesday, for example, at 7:30, we create a space where we all feel not necessarily equal, but we all have equal access to that space, that given moment.
What are the narratives we explore throughout the piece?
Possibilities and impossibilities, I would say. That idea of togetherness, in a kind of like in a bit more poetic ways, but also in a very pragmatic, like visceral and physical ways. Yeah, the idea of otherness, the idea of migration, the idea of adaptation, the idea of resilience, the yeah, the ways of really actually, again, in a very pragmatic way, coming together for like an hour or 2 hours or a day or some days, how much time you want to define, and actually be able to see each other. Not necessarily become friends. We're not talking about, you know, any sort of a kumbaya, you know, kind of like approach to the world, but really, you know, of the idea of respect, the idea of dignity, the idea of equal access, the idea of presence in a given moment in time, in a given space as well.
Please explain philoxenia, the love of strangers.
Yes, that's the other big thread of our kind of like way of working that ties kind of like all those ideas together. I mean, in ancient Greek, that was a custom. Philoxenia is like, which is it's a compound word. Philos, which is a friend, and xenos, which is the stranger. So it literally means love of strangers. And it was a very specific custom. All households, and you know, Homer describes that very, very well in the Odyssey. It was a custom where all houses they were always open to the traveler, to the stranger. Some of those houses even had specific rooms, like the architects allowed for that, to be able to host those people, those travelers and those strangers. And it was really, the custom says that they wouldn't even ask their name. They wouldn't ask, you know, who they are. First, they would start with, you know, the basic needs. They would feed them, they would provide shelter, they would provide clean water, and then they would engage with them in like, okay, who you are. And of course, so that idea of hosting could last a couple of days, and that always even gifts came with that idea of hosting, that idea of philoxenia. And the thing that it's, I mean, a part of the very act itself, which sounds very radical today, is the more radical for me idea in that concept is that it bounded the generations to come. So like, if you had asked shelter, you, Sheila, at my house, then our kids, if we were to have one, or like our relatives, were bound from that act of hospitality that we shared. So in that idea, so really the idea in, you know, tying together everything, that the idea of the possibility and impossibility of actually being together, we are really trying to like approach us as the creators of this show, of this piece, of really kind of like how can we be the hosts, how we can create the conditions of that access with no waiting anything in return. So yeah, that's kind of like the idea, and kind of like the other big thread that ties together the piece.
Where and when is The Future Is Another Country being performed?
We are opening on Tuesday, September 28th, and we are running through October 9th, which is Saturday. We are there every night except Sundays, Mondays included. We are performing on Monday as well, as just to be clear. The show is at 7:30. We are very lucky and very honored to be presented by MAI, Montreal Art Interculturel, which is a theater on 3680 Jean Mans, very close to Leo Parisot, very close to the Air Transat Tower. Yeah, and we're there every night at 7:30, exactly. The show runs about 75 to 80 minutes. It's multilingual. You will hear French, you will hear English, you will hear German and Greek and Finnish and Swedish. Yeah, that's it. And people can buy the tickets online, of course. They can call the box office, of course. They can find all the information of the box office on the site. It's the theater site, which I don't have in front of me right now, but also they can find all the information on our site, www.buluki.com. All the information about the show and all the links, necessary links about addresses and box office, everything is there. And we have also, I would like to say, we have a spectrum of options about ticketing. So we have a pay what you decide option, and we have various options about what people want to pay. So we're trying to like create also through our ticketing scheme the idea of access. We're also applying that in our box office, so people like really can just reserve the seat, and when they come to the theater, they can contribute in a box the money that they want to contribute.
Well, thank you for your interview today.
Thank you, Sheila.
You have been listening to Manolis Antonayu of Buluki Theater speaking about his latest piece, The Future is Another Country. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
Throughout the pandemic, our kids have shown how strong, patient, and resilient they can be. But now, it's time for them to make memories again. With family and friends, with teammates, with peers. Vaccination against COVID-19 can help kids get back to being kids. Help protect your child and those around them. Book your child's vaccination when it's available to them. A message from the Government of Canada.
The Good Arabs grounds the reader in place, language, and the body. Peeling and rinsing radishes. Dancing as a preteen to Nancy Ajram. Being drenched in stairs on the city bus. The collection is an interlocking and rich offering of the speaker's communities, geographical surroundings, both expansive and precise, and family, both biological and chosen. With us today, we have the author of The Good Arabs, Eli Turek. Hi, Eli, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to write The Good Arabs.
Hi, I'm Eli Tariq Al-Bashalin Al-Lynch, and as mentioned, I'm the author of The Good Arabs. I first came to write The Good Arabs about 7 or 8 years ago when I was still in school at Concordia, but it was a really early iteration of what this book looks like now. And the poems were kind of disparate and didn't have a center or anything connecting them. And then after finishing school, I kind of put the project away and wrote my second book, Not Body. And once I had finished writing Not Body, and I had already pitched The Good Arabs to Metonymy Press and they had accepted it, I knew that I had to change the book again because I had learned a lot from writing Not Body. So then I kind of overhauled the book and rewrote a bunch of it, and then it became what it is today.
What is the funniest anecdote you tell in The Good Arabs?
I wouldn't say there's anecdotes exactly, but there is these fictionalized conversations with Arabs that I have in the book, which create a fictionalized encounter between two Arabs or between an Arab speaker and the audience. And the questions are kind of silly sometimes, and they're trying to ask each other things that they're not even sure that they understand. And I try to take on kind of the classic trope or, you know, situation where two people are fighting over the check and who's going to pay for the check. And I feel like this is something I see a lot of Arab comedians talk about and a lot of Arabs on the internet. And so I kind of try to push that idea even further and have these two characters fighting over the check. So I think the humor comes out in those conversations with Arabs.
What is your background as a writer?
Well, as I mentioned a bit, I went to Concordia and did an undergrad in creative writing. But before that, I was just an avid reader as a teen and wrote a lot of prose and wrote a lot of fan fiction. And then I went to Concordia and did an undergrad, which taught me a lot about writing and kind of changed my ideas about writing. And then after that, I wrote my first book, Not Body, and then this book, The Good Arabs. So that's kind of my trajectory.
Would you please read us 4 minutes passages from your book?
Yeah, sounds good. So I'm going to read some of the conversations with Arabs. Conversation number one. What is Phoenicia? It is us. But what is us? I do not know. Are we Arabs? I was told not. By who? I don't know. Where does your family come from? They don't know.
Neither do mine. But they say Phoenicia long ago. When is that? I do not know. Does she still live on, this Phoenicia? Why is she a woman? Aren't all landmasses women? That's transphobic. You're right. I wrote an essay about it. Enough about that now. What is a body called when it's suffering? What is the rubble when it's left behind? What? What? Are we not talking about Arabs? Are Arabs not rubble? Are Arabs not suffering? Are Arabs not joy? Are Arabs not singing? Are Arabs not extremists? Are Arabs not dangerous? Are Arabs not diverse? Are Arabs not religious? The buildings are growing higher and higher. Buildings cost too much. What buildings? The ones lost in the war. The war was so long ago. There are many people alive to remember it. But can't we forget? But shouldn't we remember? Conversation number two with a foreigner. Have you ever seen garbage piled up so high you cannot see the front entrance of an apartment building? I have only seen garbage and dumps going on for kilometers. Do you think that's a better way? I don't like to see it. I don't like to smell it. Is ignorance bliss? We have newer incinerators, newer technologies. They're keeping us safe. Who are they? They do not speak. But you're right, the incinerators we have are old. We do not have a comprehensive, solid waste management strategy. What do those words mean? I don't know. Then why do you say them to me? I just parody the headlines and news articles. It is unsafe. I thought you didn't like to see it. I choose what I like to see. There again is the choice. Conversation number three. Someone should do something about this. What is this? All of this. You gesture, but there's so much it could be. I mean, everything. But who is someone? I'm not sure. Why not you? It can't be me. Why not? I'm so far away. Then why don't you go a little closer? I don't want to lose my comfort. What? Isn't that always the way? And then I'm going to jump a little bit. Conversation number six. Play Fairuz. No, I want to listen to Kalthoum. Not this evening. What about Dalida? La. How about Saba? Oof, no, no. Let's listen to Negat El Sahira. Who is she? Khalas, I figured it out. Do you have any Abdul Halim Hafiz records? Oh, no, no. I only listen to women. How come? The diva is the center of the Arab world. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Eli. How does the fact that you are queer affect your work?
I think that, I mean, first and foremost, I write about queer things. I write about being queer. There's a short story right in the middle of The Good Arabs, and it's about two queers kind of navigating living in Lebanon during another war, like another fictionalized war in the year 2040. I have this called Nancy Ashram Made Me Gay. I think it is something that I explore a lot in my work and is just kind of inherent. I think because I'm queer, I write about being queer, and it's not so much something I'm actively thinking about, but something that just naturally comes out. So I think it's pretty present in my work.
What activities do you do when you're not writing? How do these activities influence your work?
The first thing that came to mind when you asked that is reading, which feels like a cop-out because it's not so far from the writing. But I am a big nerd and I have a lot of books and I love to read. But I think I like to consume media in general, like movies and TV shows. And I really like talking to people about them. So I often really like going to book clubs or watching things with other people and discussing them. And I think that pretty easily directly translates to my work, because when discussing books or movies or TV shows, I end up talking a lot about what I like and what I think works and doesn't work in the specific thing that I'm consuming. And I think I take a lot of that into my own work and thinking about what works and what doesn't work.
If our listeners want more information or to buy your book, where should they go?
I am on Instagram and Twitter at the only Eli Tarek. So that's the only E-L-I-T-A-R-E-Q. They can find my book on Mitanni Press's website, and they can buy it because it came out three days ago now. So it's officially out, and it's also available at different bookstores. So in Montreal, there's Librairie Drouin & Quarterly and St. Henry Books.
Thank you for your interview today.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Eli Tarek from Metonymy Press, speaking about their latest work, The Good Arabs. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
Is this for real? You're gonna tell me how I feel. Are you for real? Give me hope just to steal. Need a little hope.
You're listening to Radio CKUT 90.3 FM Montreal, or online at ckut.ca.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Senate Republicans voted unanimously Monday to block a House-approved bill that would fund the federal government and raise the ceiling on the national debt. The vote came just days before a September 30th deadline to avert a government shutdown. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said Republicans' actions were threatening to plunge the U.S. into a recession.
Our country is staring down the barrel of two totally Republican-manufactured disasters, a government shutdown and a first-ever default on the national debt. The impacts of both would gravely harm every single American in this country.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has notified Congress that unless it acts before mid-October to raise the debt ceiling, the U.S. government will default on its debts. Arizona Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema has scheduled to hold a fundraiser today with five business lobbying groups that oppose a massive spending bill containing some of the Biden administration's top legislative priorities. That's according to the New York Times, which reports those in attendance are being asked to write checks for up to $5,800 to Senator Sinema's campaign. She says she opposes the spending bill's price tag of $3.5 trillion. Over 10 years, the legislation would increase taxes on wealthy individuals and corporations in order to expand the social safety net, improve worker rights, and combat the climate crisis.